I sometimes wish that I could go back to the blissful ignorance of my youth. When I was a boy going to church, if one of the members had become involved in sexual immorality, nobody would have talked about that in front of me. Or if they had, they would have used coded language that a kid didn't understand. I would have been blissfully unaware of the scandal. It's different as an adult, isn't it? Especially as a preacher and one time as an elder. Far too often I have had a front row seat to the ugly details. I wish I didn't know. It happens too frequently, brothers and sisters. Satan uses the God-given desire that we feel for the opposite sex, and he lures us beyond God's boundaries into sexual sin. And the consequences are terrible. I have sat and grieved with the guilty. I have tried to console the betrayed. I have labored with churches in the aftermath of leaders involved in immorality who were trying to move beyond the scandal. It is ugly and painful. And I suspect in a crowd of this size that there are people here for a variety of reasons who know exactly what I'm talking about. You've been there in one way or another. It occurs to me there's a whole lot that ought to be said about that. There needs to be a warning about the danger and about the terrible damage that can be done. That's not what I want to do this morning. I've chosen a different path. I'd rather focus on prevention than on the problem. What can I do to protect my marriage and my family and this church family that I love and care about? What can I do to protect them from sexual sin? I invite you to make the lesson this morning very personal. How do I protect my family from this? How do we protect one another from this? How do I protect my marriage from this? Can I be candid with you this morning? I do not like this lesson. I don't like preaching about this. The slide for our weekend in the Word is behind me. In just a few weeks, we've got some outstanding speakers that are going to come and talk to us about how we build Christ-centered homes. And I can think of about 1,000 other lessons related to marriage and family and how we build great families. We're going to hear a lot of those in a couple of weeks. And I can tell you, I would much rather talk about that. So let me ask you, when is the right time to talk about this? After it happens? That strikes me as too late, doesn't it? It seems wiser to warn in advance of the grave danger and how we protect ourselves against it, doesn't it? And so the lesson for me and you, I hope that as we think about this morning, maybe it might help us to avoid the carnage that follows sexual immorality. So I want us to think this morning about building some fences that will protect us. Now, I must confess that as I was thinking about my slides for this lesson, The first fence I chose was this one. I really like that picture. I think it's a pretty picture. And as I sat there and looked at it on my monitor, I thought, that is the wrong fence. It's too dainty for this topic, too pretty for this ugly topic. I found a better one. How about that one? Because I want you to think with me this morning, not about building a little white picket fence, but a nice, tall, sturdy, hurricane-surviving wooden fence, right? That we can set as a boundary to protect ourselves, to protect our families. So let's talk about some of the boards that need to go in the fence. Can we do that? I want to begin with this. Number one, to protect our marriages and our family from sexual sin, first of all, we need to stay close to God. Can we start at that point? We need to stay close to God. In fact, it occurs to me that that shouldn't be limited to this particular kind of temptation, because in reality, in all of our battles with temptation, this is a starting point. Staying close, staying tight with God, having a strong relationship with my Father who is in heaven. And I'll tell you why I say that. I think the more closely I walk with Him, while I'm not protected completely against sin, it's just harder to pull me into it. Doesn't that make sense? The closer I'm tied to Him, it's harder to pull me away. But as I begin to wander out on the fringes of spirituality and get further away from God, and my relationship is with Him is weak, I think it makes us more vulnerable to the devil, right? Easier for him to pull me away. Let me tell you one of the reasons I say that. I was following the story years ago of a gospel preacher who became involved in a terrible case of sexual immorality. When I say I was following the story, I don't mean I was keeping up with all the gossip. His conduct was criminal. And he was at the time fleeing the police. It was in the news. Talk about a horrible scandal. And eventually he was arrested, and he was thrown in jail, and a reporter came and interviewed him. This is what he said about his spiritual life. He said, "My faith wasn't as strong as I thought it was." And continued, "I hadn't studied the word or prayed in months. I was so weak." What do you think about that? Here is a guy that is still getting up every Sunday and teaching Bible class. And standing in a pulpit like this and preaching to an audience like I am today. And day by day throughout his week, carrying on the ordinary behaviors and activities of a gospel preacher. The facade was solid. Nobody suspected a thing. But inwardly, he was a broken mess. And I think his tragic story, though extreme, is a powerful example of what we are susceptible to when what we put on Sunday at the church building on the outside is not the inner reality, and that relationship with God is suffering and weak. I'm not close to Him. So what do we do about this? It isn't rocket science, folks. We talk about it all the time, that stuff that makes us strong spiritually. And so, first of all, as in any relationship, there's got to be communication between me and God. That is the heart of it. I have to let Him speak to me all the time. Look at the 119th Psalm this morning. Psalm 119, and look down at verse number 9. The question is asked, Psalm 119, verse 9, how can a young man keep his way pure? What's the answer that the psalmist gives? By keeping it according to your word. Do you see? Do you see how the pure life is directed by the compass of the word. And then verse 11, your word have I treasured in my heart that I may not sin against you. It is the word of God that's laid up on the heart, engraved on the heart, that keeps us pointed and oriented in the right direction. When I'm tempted, when I'm struggling, I've got that voice of God in my head over and over again from what I've read and what I've studied, telling me the way that I ought to go and how I ought to be living. But there's another half to that process. I need to let him communicate with me and speak to me. But I need to speak to him too. And so Colossians 4 and verse 2, Paul says, be devoted to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving. In 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 17, pray without ceasing, be praying all the time. Can I suggest to you that it isn't just the power that prayer brings into our life? There's something even more fundamental. When I talk to God all the time, I am reminded of his reality. How important is that in the battle with temptation? To be reminded that the eyes of the Lord are on man all the time and he sees everywhere I go. How important is it in the battle with temptation to keep that in front of me? And then to stay closely connected with his people. In the New Testament this time, in Hebrews 10. Hebrews 10. I have to tell you that I'm kind of embarrassed about how I used to use Hebrews 10 in my preaching when I first started preaching, because it frustrated me that my brothers and sisters were so bad about coming to church services. And so I would regularly smack them around a bit with some Hebrews 10:25, right? In fact, Jeff, I didn't even bother with the context. I just pick up in the middle of sentence and say, look, verse 25, it's commanded. And I think it is. That's just doing so much injustice to the context. That's important to this conversation. Look, the book of Hebrews is written to people wavering. And so the whole point of the book is to try to shore up their faith and get them to be devoted to the Lord. Hebrews 10 has just this little clip, this suggestion to help along the way with that. If you look at verse 23, we see that. Look at verse 23 of chapter 10. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. God doesn't waver, you don't waver either. That's the message. And so 24, let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds. Your brothers and sisters are going to help you with this. So, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another all the more as you see the day drawing near. See, there's so much more here than just saying, come to church. It's reminding us of how much we need our relationships with each other, how we need to stay close to each other, how we encourage each other along the way. That's part of a healthy relationship with God. When I'm tight with other disciples, it's harder to pull me back off into the world. And then I could add this, to be invested in the works of God, zealous for good deeds, finding my little spot on the wall in the kingdom of God, to stay busy with my labor. Listen, that's a different sermon, right? And I'm about to preach it. How we stay strong spiritually. You've heard that sermon before, though. All I'm trying to do is set it in this context. One of the boards we put in this fence that protects us from sexual sin is to keep my relationship close with God. Listen, it doesn't mean I'm not vulnerable at all, because we're always vulnerable. But it does serve as a line of protection. Do you see that? The closer I am to God, the more difficult it is for the devil to pull me away. Okay, so there's the first board in our fence. Let's add a second one. I need to be close to God. And secondly, I need to stay close to my spouse. So make your way to Proverbs 5. Let's work there a little bit. In Proverbs chapter 5. If you go back and read Proverbs 5, 6, and 7, it seemed to me that that whole context through there is addressing the danger of adultery. And so we're really just grabbing one little segment of a lengthy discussion of this danger, of this problem. Picking up in chapter 5 in verse 15, he speaks to the young man about his own marriage. And he says this in verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Are you following that? You see what he's saying? It's not about water, right? Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Again, are you following that? You see what he's saying? Verse 18. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. Now it's becoming clear, right? As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. You follow? Your desires are meant for each other and only for each other. You see it? Sexual desire. Only satisfied within the boundaries of a marriage relationship. And so watch what he does here. That's what he says at the end of verse 19. Be exhilarated always with her love. Verse 20, for why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and to embrace the bosom of a foreigner? Do you see the contrast between 19 and 20? You see what he's doing there? With your wife. Not with somebody else. You be exhilarated with her love, not the love of somebody else. And he says some other things here. There's a pretty good sermon, in fact, that follows along here. Verse 21, for the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his path. God sees what we're doing. His own iniquities will capture the wicked, and he will be held with the cords of his sin. He will die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, he will go astray. A lot of bad stuff's going to happen to you if you don't listen to my counsel here. Do you follow it, folks? What's he saying? He's saying marriages that are healthy and meet needs serve as a line of defense. When things are good at home, it's not guaranteed, but it protects me from becoming involved in sexual sin. But when marriages are dysfunctional and important needs are unmet, it makes me more susceptible to the devil's assault. Doesn't that just make sense, right? By the way, there's something else here. And I want you guys who are single, I want y'all to hear this. This focus on marriage as a place where sexual desires are satisfied also applies to those who are not yet married. We need to be careful in our youth that we do not develop a lifestyle, a habit of moving from one sexual relationship to another, because then when we're married, we've started a life pattern that's difficult to break because now I'm in a marriage and I'm supposed to be devoted to this one. Listen, you're supposed to be devoted to that one even before you marry her, right? That's why I wait until that time. That was a freebie. I just threw that in on the side. So what happens in our marriage, brothers and sisters, as time goes by really is important. We can't allow the passing of years to cause us to neglect this relationship. We need to continually work to build marriages that are strong. In fact, it's interesting to me that we have a whole book of the Bible that helps us with romantic love within our marriages. It helps us with the sexual relationship. And oddly enough, in this season of life, it is the most unknown book in the whole Bible. When's the last time you heard a sermon from the Song of Solomon? Maybe that's because we're all trying to figure it out. I don't know. But there is some beautiful poetry there. I don't have time to unpack all that this morning, but can I tell you that if you'll go back and read the poems, there's some fundamentals you're going to find there. For example, when I read the poems, And in these poems, there are people who are in love with each other, a man and a woman in love with each other. I learned some things as I watched the two of them interact in the poetry. For example, I learned that they spend a lot of time together. Do you see the word companionship on the slide? See, those were supposed to pop up one at a time. And I don't know why the technology failed, but you got it in advance, okay? That's just more soaking time for you. They spend time together. One moment they're sitting at a banquet together, and then the next moment they're out watching or walking in nature. But the point is, they are together. Companionship. That's a dimension of love. And listen, couples need to do that. We spend time together. And I'm not saying we're all at the house at the same time at the end of the day. I'm saying, like, you need to keep dating each other. Don't let 30 days go by without the two of you taking some time away from the kids, just the two of you, to be alone with each other, to go sit in the back of a dark restaurant and talk to each other, communicate. In fact, I see that when I read the song too. I see loving communication going back and forth between these two people who are in love. I mean, they're not just sitting around talking about what the schedule is today and when are we going to meet up this afternoon. They communicate about each other. They express their affection and their love for each other. In fact, one of the things that's interesting about this poetry, it's poetry, but Randy, it has lists that don't seem to work with poetry to me. But nonetheless, sometimes she'll have a big old list describing how wonderful her guy is. And I know over and over again, he's got a big old list describing how wonderful she is. They got a list on each other. You got a list on your spouse? What's on it? Good stuff? That you talk about and share back and forth? Come on, guys, when's the last time you had a private moment with your wife and looked into her eyes, told her how beautiful she was, how much she meant to you, how you were still in love with her, how you appreciated and rattled off your list? That's part of it. It's in the poetry about marriage that God put in the book. And then when I read these poems, I see the care that these two people have for each other. In fact, early on in one of the poems, the woman is feeling insecure about her appearance. From what I could read in the poetry, it sounds like that she was a country boy, or country girl rather, who was in the palace, and she's around all these kept women, and her skin's kind of dark from being in the fields, and they're all light-skinned because they've been inside all this time. Evidently, it hasn't always been good to have a tan, okay? In that culture, it was different. And she's really self-conscious about that, and he sees that. Think about that. He knows how she's feeling. He sees it, and he does something about it. You know what he does? He comes to her and says, "You are my number one horse." I know. I tried that on my wife. Does not work at all. And she likes horses. It still didn't work. It's the nature of the poetry. Different culture, different times. They would think our expressions of affection were weird too, okay? So we're all together in this. But the point is, he's taking care of her. And it stirs within her this desire, this craving even for physical intimacy. There's a point in chapter 2 where he has done something, some really outward expression that others could see of his affection for her. And she is so stirred up by that. Well, I mean, I could read this to you. It's going to sound kind of weird, right? But she says in verse 5, "Sustain me with raisin cakes." I don't like raisins. That doesn't help me. "Refresh me with apples because I am lovesick." I know what that means, right? She's just overwhelmed with that. And then she says, "Let his left hand be under his head, under my head, and his right hand embrace me." That's code language. She's saying, "I want him to make love to me." But then verse 7, evidently, they're still in the dating phase. And she says, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the hinds of the fields, that you will not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases." But what he was doing that exactly that. It's awakening her love for him, her desire for him. And the caution is, not till the time is right. Y'all remember that too. Wait for the right time. Folks, this isn't rocket science. What keeps love alive in marriage is just the basic stuff that we already know. We just have to keep working at it. I know we go through seasons. Marriages have rough spots. You got to work through those rough spots, but you got to work through those rough spots. Because I think the stronger the marriage is, the more difficult it is for the devil to pull us off into sexual sin. Now, we have all that there. You see that, right? Even after all that is squared away, let me add some to the list. Even after all that squared away, you feel great about your relationship with God, marriage is strong. When that's squared away, then let me add this. Don't be arrogant. Sounds like an odd thing to say, doesn't it? But my fear is that when we feel like we got this locked down, we're close to God, we're close in our marriage, and all that is good, we think we're not going to be susceptible to the devil. And what happens when we get prideful and arrogant and we think, I'm not in danger? What happens to us? You know, right? We stop being careful and we let our guard down. And we put ourselves in risky situations and make ourselves vulnerable to the devil's assault. And so there's wisdom about that too. Proverbs 16 and verse 18. You know this one. Pride goes before the fall, and a haughty spirit before destruction. Don't ever say, I would never cheat on my wife. Don't ever say, I would never get involved in using pornography. Don't say that. Instead, say, because those are very real dangers for me, I'm going to be careful. I'm going to be cautious. I know the devil's pursuing us. I know the devil uses sexual sin to pull us away from God. And so I'm going to be very, very careful that I don't engage in risky behavior. You buy that? Because sometimes, brothers and sisters, I don't even think we realize that the things we're doing are risky. So maybe, for example, in your job, work throws you together with someone of the opposite sex. Guys, you are partnered on a project with a lady or vice versa. Let me ask you a question. Does that sound an alarm with you? Does your brain say, ooh, I need to be careful here? Because there could be risks here. Does that happen? And maybe you're saying, oh, you preachers just don't know how the real world works. Or maybe we do. Because you see, if I'm partnered with a person of the opposite sex at work, what are we going to be doing? Item one on the list. We're going to spend time together. Maybe a lot of time together. On this project, lots and lots of hours at work, every single day, working together. What is that? Companionship. We're working on this thing together. Should we be concerned about the danger there? And then as we work together, day after day, hour by hour, we start talking. And not just about things related to the project. I mean, you do that with coworkers, right? Jeff and I don't talk about the Bible every time we talk here at the office. We do talk about, oh man, politics sometimes. Let's never do that. Astros sometimes. Yeah, a little bit that. So maybe y'all do too. You talk about the election. You talk about politics. Talk about families. Maybe troubles in the family. Maybe their marriage isn't so good. It's really easy when you're together with somebody all the time and you're talking about other stuff for that conversation to become more personal, intimate, even. I'm asking you, does that kind of sound alarm bells for you when conversations start going that way? Does that concern you? And maybe along the way, they're in a mess and you feel bad about that. And so you try to say things that are consoling and comforting. I'm trying to be caring of that person. And the next thing that you know, unexpectedly, there is this desire that is stirred. It's not rocket science, folks. Sexual morality has a source, and often it's the very kind of things that make a marriage great. We're just engaging with that behavior with someone who has no business being involved in that behavior with me. What am I trying to say? We need to be very, very careful. Don't be arrogant and say, oh, this wouldn't happen to me. I would never do that. What I say is because it can. Okay, I'm going to put this board in my fence. I need to be really, really cautious when I have to interact with the opposite sex. Now, going on beyond that, let me add this. As I do that, I think we need to appreciate the possibilities. The terrible possibilities when I cross the boundaries. I don't know if you're like me, but I do not understand what David did in 2 Samuel 11. Does that story bother you? I don't know how David did that. The Spirit says he's a man after God's own heart, so I know David isn't a fraud. He's a good guy, fundamentally. But beyond that, he knows the law of God. He knows the law well. And beyond that, David would know that the eyes of the Lord are on him all the time, that God watches all his path. He sees everything that's going on. So how does he do this thing with Bathsheba? How does that happen? It's the same questions we could ask about every moral failure. Isn't it bizarre that a disciple who knows the Word of God, who knows that God sees, could allow himself to become involved in sexual immorality? How does that happen? Dr. Russell Moore made an interesting observation about this while commenting on a moral scandal several years ago involving a politician. He said this: temptation only works if the possible futures open to you are concealed. Consequences, including those of judgment day, must be hidden from view or outright denied. Do you see that? I have to convince myself I can pull this off and nobody's going to find out. This will not harm my marriage. This will not damage my children. I can get away with it. And I know when you're sitting in a church auditorium on a Sunday morning, that sounds so irrational, doesn't it? And yet that's what we tell ourselves. That takes down the barrier. I wonder sometimes, if David could have known in advance, if David could have seen into the future, see what's coming for his family, see what's coming for his kingdom as a result of his sin with Bathsheba, I wonder, you think he'd have done something different that night on the rooftop in Jerusalem? If he had really appreciated what was coming? I spent 12 years over at Dallin Road working in a partnership with Max Dawson, and as part of that, training a whole series of interns. One of the things Max used to say to the young men who worked with us is you need to learn to see today's decisions with tomorrow's eyes. Learn to see today's decisions with tomorrow's eyes. And then he would talk to them about what tomorrow will look like if they, as a preacher, become involved in sexual immorality. Beginning with a warning that if they ever did cheat on their wife, he and I would hunt them down and kill them and bury them where the body would not be found. I am serious, he said that to the boys, and I think they thought he meant it. I don't know. You know, it was helpful for me to listen to that conversation over and over again with every intern. To see today's decisions with tomorrow's eyes. To have that capacity to look beyond the moment at the potential catastrophe from my actions. Boy, if we could put that as a board in the fence, if we had the capacity to do that, would it change some of our choices? Last thing I want to say to you, Last board in the fence. Find someone to hold you accountable. I put this on the list because years ago I was reading a book by this preacher who said that every 30 days there was an older gentleman he respected in the church where he was working that he had a standing appointment with. They would meet up with coffee once a month, and he had given this guy permission to ask him some really personal questions. He had given this guy permission to say, in the last 30 days, have you cheated on your wife? In the last 30 days, have you looked at pornography? In the last 30 days, have you had thoughts about other women that you shouldn't have? And he said that accountability helped him deal with his temptations. Can you see how that would happen? Because if he was ever tempted to do the wrong thing, here's the reality he was faced with. Somewhere within 30 days or less, he was going to be sitting in front of his good friend and he was going to be asked these questions. And if he caved to the temptation, one of two awful things would happen. He'd have to lie to his friend next time they had coffee. Or he'd have to own that ugly sin to him. And both were terribly distasteful. Late one night, I got a call from a friend. He said, I need you to come over to my house right now. I mean, it's like after midnight, so 1-2 in the morning. I go over to this guy's house. And he just starts pouring it out, just confessing that he for years has had this terrible habit of using pornography. He said, I've tried and tried to stop. I just can't. I'm sick of the guilt. I'm sick of feeling this way. I just need to tell someone I need some help. And so that night, I agreed to be his accountability partner. After months had gone by and regular check-ins, he told me it was the only thing he had ever done that actually helped him stop. He had to be accountable to someone. And so I don't know, maybe you need that board in your fence. If you've been struggling over and over again and just not winning the battle, maybe it's time to find someone that you can be accountable to. Maybe that's your answer. Scripture urges us to confess our sins to one another and pray for one another. So as I was putting this lesson together, I had a couple of thoughts. I worried about it a little bit. One thought I had as I was gathering my thoughts on this is, how's this going to land with the crowd? How will it be heard? I really wondered if there would be people who would think some of this was extreme. Like David doesn't really function in the real world. He's a preacher. He goes to the office at the church building every day. And some of this stuff he's talking about, I just think it's silly. So if there's a temptation in your mind today to say, I just think that's over the top. I don't think the danger is that great. I don't think we have to go that far. Whatever you may have said in your mind, let me ask you this. You believe in the devil? I mean, really, do you believe there's an adversary out there trying to destroy us? And do you believe that one of his tactics is to destroy us with sexual sin? And do you believe that you could be susceptible to that assault? And do you believe that if you cave, the consequences will be catastrophic? You believe that? And you're going to tell me it's silly to be really, really careful when you're interacting with opposite sex on the job? The second thing that occurred to me is how difficult it would be to respond to the invitation today. My guess is the pews will be empty when we get done up here. And I think one of the reasons that is true is because we say to ourselves, I could never acknowledge this kind of sin that we've talked about today. I can't do it. People will judge me. It will destroy my reputation among the disciples. They'll shun me. They'll turn away from me. I could never do that. I have to keep the secret. So here's the thing I'd like to say to you about that. That is a lie of the devil. I've been doing this 40 years. And I've taken a lot of confessions down on this front row of terrible, scandalous activities. And I've shared it with a church family. I've never seen someone left alone up here because their brothers and sisters shunned them. Not once. Just the opposite. Devil wants you to believe that so you'll keep the secret. And you won't deal with your sin. I tell you what will happen. If you're ready to let it go this morning, this church family will surround you and they will love you and they will pray for you and they will encourage you. And if you need it, they'll hold you accountable. They will help you be victorious. You know what question you have to answer today is? You believe the devil? You know, keep going on in this mess? Or do you finally want to be free? Your choice. You decide as we stand, as we sing.